another Yes to Life show, the show dedicated to investigating the frontiers of integrative medicine for cancer. I'm Robin Daly, founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, that's helping people with cancer to find out about and access integrative medicine. In today's show, we'll be taking a long, hard look at the level of success that EBM, or evidence-based medicine, is achieving in getting the best treatments to cancer patients. To help me in this, I'm being joined by expert health writer Jerome Byrne, who takes a great interest in the forces at work in the development of medicine. I'm speaking to Jerome over Skype at his home in West London. Hi Jerome, thanks a lot for coming on the Yes to Life show.
Pleasure.
Okay, so your latest post is entitled "Most New Cancer Drugs Won't Let You Live Longer or Improve Your Quality of Life." So this is a little bit at odds with the winning the war on cancer messages that we get bombarded with by the tabloids and the cancer charities, to say the least. But how do you justify such a sweeping claim?
Well, it is, of course, not based on me, but as a humble journalist, I just report what I find. And it is a rather remarkable study, which has just came out not last week, week before, in the BMJ, where they looked at what happens to drugs after they've been through the licensing process and how many of them need to have good evidence when they go through that. And then if there are doubts about the evidence, the companies are supposed to follow up and satisfy the regulator that the evidence is good. And what's been discovered is that for years, they haven't really been doing that. And when I say just being discovered, it actually was very clear that there were problems with this regulatory process, at least back in nearly over 7 years ago and further back than that. So you're absolutely right. There is a picture that all is fine. We have drug companies working away to produce new, exciting, effective products. We have a regulatory body that says, we've checked over the data, we've looked at your trials, it all seems fine, this is clearly a valuable new product, we'll get it out on the market and off you go. That's a story we've been told. What this study, which has just come out in the BMJ, shows is, first of all, that many of the drugs, if not actually the majority of the drugs, which get licensed through this was the European licensing body, the European Medicine Agency. What they had been doing was to say, well, the evidence that you've got is not very strong, but we'll let the drug through and then you can do a test later on and show exactly how good it is. The main test that they use, which is agreed within the business to be a dodgy one, but is still widely used all the same, is tumour shrinkage. So that they'll say, look, we've given this drug to a number of people, their tumours have shrunk, and the agency says, oh, okay, get it out on the market. And when they started looking at how many drugs had been passed on that basis, and then how many of them had shown up as actually working well, the results were dreadful, is the only way to put it.
Wow.
What they found was that two-thirds, i.e. 57% of new cancer drugs that went through the European agency between 2009 and 2013 were passed on the basis of this making the tumour shrink. So the question then becomes, well, what happened when they followed things up? And what it turned out was that something like 18 of the 30 or so drugs that had gone through had been found to provide no benefit at all. And not only that, but very few of them had actually, 30% of them hadn't even checked to run a further test to see what was going on. So this idea of a clearly checked new drug, which then is licensed, isn't what it is. They license it on the basis that it looks promising. They're then supposed to test again. And then when they don't do it, or even when they do find that the drug isn't any better, despite having this tumour shrinking, they don't then withdraw it. So there are still drugs out there which have been nodded through as great new developments, really important. They've turned out not to be, and yet they're still being used by clinicians. What I think is the really extraordinary thing, well, actually two things. One is that there hasn't been any, my God, this is awful, what can we do about it? How can we tighten things up? The sort of thing you get when Volkswagen have been found to not been properly testing for pollutants and so on. Quite different. It's in fact, there were several of the reports said, this is really not something to worry about. People shouldn't stop taking their drugs. And it's something which is being looked into. That's the kind of current calming people down, don't be too worried. I mean, what makes it even worse is that the BMJ paper refers to the fact that 2 years ago, in 2015, an American research group did pretty well the same thing on drugs that have been licensed in America and found almost exactly the same results. Right. In other words, a significant proportion had been licensed on these rather dodgy assumptions about the markers, that shrinking tumours was a good sign it would work. And again, the majority of them didn't show any better 4 years down the line. And again, they haven't been taken off the market. And again, the regulators haven't demanded that there's any change or really publicised it. So we've got, over the last 8 years, there's been this practice of licensing drugs, not following it up properly, and it's still going on.
All right, well, I think you've spelled it out there. Pretty amazing state of affairs, really. It's a mess, isn't it?
Yes, it's a mess. And of course, the implications of it, well, first of all, that patients are getting drugs which it's very likely are not going to benefit them at all, but it's also very likely they're going to come with some quite serious side effects. So they're suffering the nausea and the all the other problems, the damage, the lining of the esophagus and so on, for no chance of benefiting at all. In fact, one of the researchers who was doing the work that was published in the BMJ, which was being done at King's College in London, actually said that these drugs are giving false hope to patients. It's probably familiar with that phrase, which is obviously usually used to describe complementary therapies, that they the worst thing they do is give this, leaving aside whether false hope is an oxymoron or not.
Right.
It's clearly, it would seem to me, two things come out of it. One is the regulators need to do their job. But the other thing is, given that there is this slack regulation and what patients are getting is clearly not scientifically proven, evidence-based medicine. They're getting something much more creaky and unreliable than that, which makes it even harder to support the idea that really anything that isn't drug-based should be ignored, and it's probably quackery and false hope and all these other things that anyone who doesn't use drugs is accused of. All of that becomes far less convincing. And it's obvious that cancer patients need all the help they can get. And if it comes from improving the way the body works, that would seem to make a lot of sense.
Yeah. Okay, well, look, we're going to get into all of that as the show goes on. So we're off to a great start. This is kind of a lift the lid on what's called evidence-based medicine, or EBM. That's what we're about today. And we want to see just how EBM is actually contributing to our health and well-being. So there's several factors really leading to the present situation, the one you've just described, where you've got an enormously costly system that's intended to prove that drugs work and actually help people with cancer. It's actually largely useless. So I'd like to look at them one by one because they're important. Now, you've already mentioned an important one, which is called surrogate endpoints. So this is, as you described, well, the tumour shrunk. This is called a surrogate endpoint because there's nothing to say that it is actually in the patient's interest that the tumour shrunk, but it's seen as a reason to pass a drug. And there are other surrogate endpoints which get used as an alternative to the actual only endpoints that are of interest to a patient, which are their quality of life gets better or they live longer or both. This is a bit of a trick that's come up, you know, as it got harder and harder to find any reason to actually buy drugs, I'd say. Would you agree?
Well, yes. And I mean, of course, one of the reasons or the justifications given from the drug company and also from the regulator's point of view is that giving people, you either have to have a few people and then watch them for a long time to see when a significant proportion of them died and whether they died earlier than would be expected, either on other drugs or on without drugs, although there's probably nobody who doesn't get drugs these days, but there isn't a measure of extended life expectancy. In order to get some reliable data on that, you either have to have quite a lot of people who you then watch for a period where, when you get to the stage where a significant enough of them would be expected to have died, and then you can make an assessment. Or you have to have a long time. And both of those things, lots of people over a long time, push the cost up. Mm. So you've got the development costs, and this I read somewhere recently, it's not a hugely authoritative source, but it did give me pause for thought. The development costs for the new gene-linked drugs is now being quoted at over £2 billion. Mm. And one of the implications of the genetic approach is that you're going to need more drugs because you're going to be targeting a greater number of genetic variations. And they're now being able to identify and say, well, we used to think that cancer was one sort of disorder, say cancer of the colon or the breast. We now can see, because of our more sophisticated gene analysis, that there's actually, for example, four types of colon cancer, and each of those can be targeted with a different and specific drug to target their specific genes. Mm. So you've got a massive ratcheting up of the number of drugs that are needed at the same time that the cost of these drugs is soaring, and so they're desperately scrambling. And as you suggest, the NHS, the bodies who are buying these drugs are saying, you know, we really can't afford it. So anything they can do to cut the costs, and that's the benefit of these surrogate markers, the drugs will cost more because the drug companies will say, well, we've had to wait 8 years, or we've had to get 2,000 people into the trial, and all of that's expensive. Mm. So either way, it's a massively expensive route. And this is a classic, what happens when you have to start cutting costs, indications of whether something works or not.
So that £2 billion, that's what I would describe as the cost of an entry ticket into the whole drugs market. I would maintain it's something that pharmaceutical companies actually like because it's not that much money to them. And it kind of excludes everybody else. It's kind of narrows the market right down to a few massive conglomerates. And that's a good thing from their point of view.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. It's like a sort of really exclusive golf club.
Yes.
Yeah, anybody can join as long as you've got a £2 billion joining fee. Yeah.
In terms of a competition from something completely different coming in, it's pretty unlikely because they're controlling what medicine looks like.
Yes, and that this is, of course, one of the constant refrains that you can't count as a player, you can't count as having an evidence-based treatment unless you can put it through one of these big randomized controlled trials, which then takes us off on a whole other discussion about whether a randomized controlled trial of a single feature is appropriate for a lot of these holistic systems, which are really designed to get the body to handle or resist cancer more effectively rather than just trying to knock it on the head.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so that's right. The trial model actually fits very well with the product in that case, doesn't it?
Yes. Mm.
Yeah, so another factor that's very much implicated in the way the trials have gone is who actually does them. And of course, they're very largely done by the companies who actually produce them. So the chances of objectivity from a company that's out to make a profit and to sell their product and certainly doesn't want to ditch it because it didn't succeed the trial, well, they're slim, I think.
I think it's what we call perverse incentives, isn't it?
Yes.
But I can just say there's one other thing here, which is, of course, that the figure that I've seen recently of the proportion of the income of the regulatory agencies that is paid for in fees by the drug companies is over 80%.
On top of that, that's another reason for lack of objectivity then.
Yeah, yes. More of a, I think, again, the phrase here is regulatory capture, I think.
Yeah. Okay, and then we have another important factor, which is to do with the patients who are selected for a trial by a company that wants their trial to succeed are inevitably not very much like the patients in real-world situations. They're kind of ideal patients who are most likely to respond to their treatment. And this is another way of skewing the results, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, two things, really. One of the classic things is to get younger, and this goes across, this is not just cancer drugs, it's a feature in most pharmaceutical testing. If you try to get somebody who is younger and fitter than the typical patient who will be getting it. I mean, most people who get lots of drugs for chronic diseases are older. You know, the biggest risk you have is getting older. So I don't know exactly what the figures for people with cancer. There are obviously children's cancers and early ones and so on, but the big majority is people, I don't know, over 50, 55, 60, something like that. That's that's where the risk starts to cut in. Interestingly, drug companies don't really believe that being healthy or having a good immune system makes much difference to your chances, but they will go for people to test who are more likely to do well, who do have these features, the better immune system, less inflammation and so on. So that's one thing. And the other thing they do is to go to people with only a single disease, so that you've just got cancer or you've just got heart disease. Whereas, again, with older people, they tend to have a number of diseases, so they may very well be taking a range of other drugs for diabetes, for example, or for arthritis, or for other conditions which are more common among the elderly, and that again makes the chances of the actual drugs having a beneficial effect smaller.
Another factor which came up in today's news about AstraZeneca is good old-fashioned corruption. Of course, they do like to cook the books if they can, because they can get a lot of money if they pull it off. So that's not a small feature, as a lot of fines go out. Some of the largest ones in history go out for pharmaceutical companies.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the AstraZeneca one, I was just sent to me earlier on today, but from what I saw, a lone researcher, this is how they were described, and
the bad apple.
Remarkably unconvincing.
Yes.
One lone researcher in this huge organisation was fiddling some of the results of the drug and how well it affected mice. But the reassuring news was that nobody else knew about it or was involved. And in the end, it didn't really impact on the subsequent clinical trials, because it was only in mice. Didn't affect the trials on humans, were all fine. And another factor which it didn't impact on was that the beneficial fake mouse study came out just a month or so before there was a big takeover or share option or some big financial deal which would be affected by how beneficial the drug was looking. Mm-hmm. But sure that this hadn't impacted on that either. So hurry along, nothing to see here, just one lone loony who we I got rid of and all is well.
Right.
This is the pattern, is that these things come up and there are, you know, there have been fudged data, there have been things ignored, there have been unreliable reports, and a fine is imposed and then it's business as usual.
Yeah, I mean, the fines, they seem very large, but of course the companies are so big that they're not really that large, and I suspect they get seen as part of the kind of marketing budget. It's like, oh yeah, we're going to pick up a few of these along the way, and it's all worth it in the long run.
Yes. If you hear interviews with some of the CEOs or senior figures, when there's been a £2 billion fine or a £3 billion fine for concealing results or so on, the line is, well, that it's really good news because that's cleared up this uncertainty and we can now move forward and really get on with delivering the best treatments for patients. And very often, I've seen it mentioned on several occasions, that when a big fine has been imposed, because this then means that you can move forward, the various senior executives involved get a bonus. Again, perverse incentives all round.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the tragedy of this situation is, of course, the consequences on huge numbers of people are enormous. Sometimes there's vast numbers of early deaths and things like that. And for some reason, never, ever does a pharma executive get strung up. You know, they don't get locked up for this. In America, if you do a fraud and you embezzle some money, they lock you away for decades. But you can kill lots of people with drugs, and it's all seemed to be somehow okay, even though all the evidence is there to show that it was quite deliberate. It would be hilarious were it not so tragic.
Yes, I mean, it does seem to be something, it does seem to be an area that escapes the normal concerns that people have about the behaviour of industries. I mean, we all get quite angry when it turns out that oil companies are destroying coral reefs, or that they've been dumping waste products and poisoning the whole fracking thing and causing poison to the water supply or damaging things, and then there are penalties and so on and so forth. And of course, more recently, the banks.
Yes.
You know, not very much has happened as a result of the behaviour of bankers and their link with the depression. But at least people are aware that there is a responsibility there. But medicine is still a kind of an exclusive preserve, really. I suppose there are reasons for it, which is that it's very frightening when you get cancer. And one of the things you want to do is to make it seem as if everything's all right. You want to be reassuring and yes, we've got treatments, and yes, we can do it, and yes, we're getting better, and so on. Unfortunately, in the case of cancer, the improvements have been very minimal ever since the famous war on cancer by Nixon back in the 1970s. A few areas have improved, but there's still not very much that can be done once a cancer has metastasized. It's really a question of having a few months of improvement.
Okay, well, there are actually quite a few more factors at work in the eventual shambles you described at the beginning, but I think I want to go on and talk about a few other things now. There's an article that caught your interest in The New Yorker, which was by the internationally acclaimed author and oncologist Siddhartha Mukherjee, in which he says that if we want to solve the riddle of metastasis, the spread of cancer, which of course is the actual killer part of the process, then we need to lift our attention away from the minutiae of genes and start looking at the condition of the body in which it's occurring. So could you tell us why this article excited you and what you think are the natural conclusions it should lead to?
Yes, I mean, Mukherjee is a highly respected clinician and author, and one of his books, The Cancer, The Emperor of Maladies, I think it was called, got brilliant reviews everywhere. What the first thing he's doing, which is very unusual, is he's going against the genetic tide. I mean, we have had ever since the reading of the human genome back in 2000, we've had increasing belief that by burrowing further and further down into the genome, we're going to find out the key to what it is that makes cancers so invasive and how they take over and what are the gene drivers that are enabling the cancer to do what it does, which sounds very plausible, sounds a very good idea. Unfortunately, it hasn't quite turned out like that, because the original idea was that there would just be a few mutations, maybe half a dozen or so, which were driving a cancer. And the more that they dig down into the genome of the cancer, the more genes that have changed they keep on finding. So this original simple idea that you just spot the genes, knock them out, and that's it, really not happening. And Mukherjee made the point to say, look, it's not just the genes of the cancer that is the key thing, because he made a very interesting analogy with the idea of a pest entering a new territory, the arrival of rabbits into Australia, or Japanese knotweed into British gardens. There are lots and lots of examples. One that I hadn't heard about before was some beavers in Tierra del Fuego. Okay. Apparently, they're anywhere where these a species goes into new territory and finds that either the conditions are ripe, or that there aren't any predators, or that they are then able to just explode. And this is what seems to be happening with cancer, that the cells are going out and they're being able to take over, because the normal features which would be controlling them for some reason aren't. So the key thing about that, as far as genes are concerned, is that if you want to know why knotweed is being so successful in taking over English gardens and countryside, or why the grey squirrels outgun the red squirrels, the answer very rarely lies in the genes of the invading species, but they lie in the conditions of the territory they're invading. So if you apply this to cancer, it's what's going on in the body that's allowing this to happen, rather than what are the particular genes. And there have been a few other people who have looked at this, and Mukherjee was very interesting in that he used metastasizing as a classic example of how the of gene model isn't enough. There's been a great attempt to find the genes that drive metastasizing, but they haven't come up with anything. You can't say he's got cancer X, which has genes which means that it's going to metastasize very quickly or effectively. So that what happens is that once a cancer has been removed surgically, the doctor then says, well, that's great, we've got it out, we think we've got all of it. But you then have to take adjuvant chemotherapy, usually, in order to prevent it coming back. And the figures on how successful adjuvant chemotherapy is very small. They don't know which ones that they need to protect against or what the best ways of doing it are. Mukherjee quotes a couple of bits of research which show just how tricky to understand is this metastasizing business, because it had been thought that somehow there were certain cancers that had a certain quality that meant that they could go off and metastasize, because metastasizing is a jolly difficult thing to do. You've got to go out into a largely hostile body and go down through the bloodstream and evade the immune system and so on and so on and so forth. So how did they manage it? And they were hoping to find some genes which were driving it. But then quite some time ago, back in the early 2000s, they found that cancers are pumping out cells to get into the bloodstream all the time. They're like those underground, those pictures that one you've probably seen for coral reefs, where there's this constant sort of puff of eggs and embryos, or, you know, kind of baby new coral reefs have been punted out into the bloodstream. And I can't remember off the top of my head the actual figures, but it was kind of grams of tumour material in the bloodstream on a kind of 24-hour basis. So if the only thing that counted was the genes in the cancer, you would expect the whole of the body to be riddled with cancer within days or weeks, but that obviously doesn't happen. So something happens between these cancer cells, which contain all of their genes in them, as we know. Each cell has a full complement. Something happens to make sure that they don't invade areas. And there's very interesting stuff that Mukherjee pointed out about certain areas more likely to be invaded than others, and so on and so forth. But the key message was that we don't really understand metastasizing. We're not going to do it by just concentrating on the qualities of the genes in the tumors. So we need to start looking at the body. And that interested me a lot, because I'd been reading some people who I know that you had been talking to in some of your conferences, who had been looking at what are the conditions surrounding a tumour that encourage it to either grow or to be brought back under control. And there's a woman called Bissell, can't think of her first name now.
Nina
Bissell, exactly, thank you. She's a cancer specialist who works in California, and she's been pointing out the importance of the surrounding cells in making a difference. She uses the analogy of neighborhoods. So she says if you've got kids being brought up in a bad neighborhood with poor housing, a lot of people on welfare, gun crime, drugs, and so on and so forth, they're going to have a pretty hard time coming up as a good citizen. So it's going to be harder. Whereas good, supportive neighborhood will be less likely to produce the obvious troubled kids. They may have other troubles, but certainly they've got a better start. And the same goes for cancer. And she identified a number of the things, some of which were very familiar, you know, things about diet and exercise and health and weight and all the sort of things about staying well and making sure your immune system was working effectively. But of course, the cancer industry pays minimal attention to that side of things. The focus is all on the drugs. And so having Mukherjee painting this picture of this invasive species, what are the conditions in the territory it's invading that make a difference, seemed to me to match absolutely perfectly onto the idea of a holistic approach, because that's precisely what most of the non-drug approaches say. They say we need to kind of help the body to fight off this thing rather than simply filling people up with toxic drugs. Say that drugs don't do any good. I'm sure they do. I'm in no position to argue, but certainly what Mukherjee was saying is that we need, I think he had a quote that says, ask not what the cancer does to you, but what you can do to the cancer, which I think is very telling. But interestingly, he kind of failed at the last fence, because he'd been constructing this very clearly stated, evidence-supported, authoritative argument about we need to look at what's going on in the body. And then the obvious thing that sort of came up along the argument was the word holistic, at which point he shied like a kind of horse at Beecher's Brook on the National or something, and said, we don't believe in holism. It's all kind of strawberries and leaves and silly herbs and patchouli-scented nonsense. Although he was then a bit stuck, because he couldn't go down the dietary route. He couldn't even go down to some of the stuff that Nina was talking about. And so having pointed out this problem, the solution that was staring him in the face was one that was just kind of forbidden by the cancer traditions and so on.
Yeah. So it's interesting, within the whole story of evidence-based medicine, there has to be a sort of overall grand story, if you like, which they're operating within. And it does change very, very slowly over time. But as you say, his article largely bucked the whole major narrative of it being all about genes, and said, well, actually, you know, metastasis is really the worst thing here, and we ought to find out how it works, and genes are not the right place to look. But as you say, this is not something that's new to the whole world of integrative medicine. They've been dealing with it for years, but they really couldn't go that far, because he was just going too far outside the box of the orthodox story. And of course, as you say, it's kind of anathema to the world of pharmaceuticals, because everybody knows there's nothing holistic about pharmaceuticals. In fact, they give the body a problem, because they're actually not supportive generally. They are all about attacking something or stopping a process. So he did get himself in a bit of a corner.
And I did find it, I found the piece fascinating. One of those pieces you read, said, oh my God, yes, so much all fits together. I have a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But at the end, I did feel depressed is probably putting it too strongly, but it seemed to me really sad that here was a top oncologist who'd made the step outside the box and had the resources and the overview and the rest of it to see what was going on. But even he couldn't say, well, you know, what makes sense is that we really need to get down and look at what's going on in the body and what can we do to reinforce it and help it and support it. And then if he can't do it, what chance is there that your oncologist or what are the new kids being taught who are coming out of med school? I mean, I know that there is an interest in integrative medicine, and there is a movement in that direction, but it's very heavily opposed, and there's lots of online skeptics who will lay into any suggestions that you dilute the scientific purity of drugs with these rather more baggy and natural therapies. If you were going to say, well, what the patients want, they clearly have voted in favour of including that. If you know, I think people vary, but there are many people who would say, I'd like to do the oncology route, but I'd like a bit of something else as well, please.
But they're the people we're helping in the main, that's correct.
Yeah.
So the fact that lifestyle is a central factor in most types of chronic disease is pretty much indisputable now. That is except for cancer, of course, where oncologists still cling to mantras such as it doesn't matter what you eat when you have cancer. And very importantly, there's no evidence that natural lifestyle approaches have any effect. So given where we started out in today's discussion, and given the relative risks of these eye-wateringly expensive toxic drugs with potentially life-changing side effects versus, say, a cheap and safe lifestyle approach, how well do you think EBM, evidence-based medicine, is serving the public?
I think one of the problems is that we don't have a high court in medicine. I mean, in theory, the evidence-based medicine system is supposed to be self-correcting. Mm. The idea is that you gather the evidence, responsible, independent, and that's perhaps a tricky issue. Independent scientists then run studies and evaluate and look to see what works and what doesn't and test out hypotheses. And then at some slightly mysterious point, they decide, actually, you know, we need to stop doing this and do that instead. Sometimes it's very, very obvious. But what's become very clear in the issues around diabetes is that the wheels grind very slowly and in a very haphazard way. I mean, over the last four or five years, there have been a number of, first of all, patients with diabetes who were reporting really good results, not by following the traditional official low-fat diet, but by following a high-fat, low-carbohydrate diet, which made sense because the problem with diabetes is that you've got too much blood sugar, or you've got a problem handling blood sugar, and the way you increase your blood sugar, very simply, is by having a high amount of carbohydrates, which is what the official diet was recommending. So patients were doing this and reporting it on the web, and then a growing number of doctors have been picking up on it. But the establishment is fighting back fiercely, and there's no kind of court, as it were, that says, let's evaluate the evidence and come up with a ruling. And so you've got a sort of very messy edging towards a difference. It is changing. There are people who are certainly... doctors are being allowed to try the low-carb approach. Not true in all countries. In South Africa and also in Australia, there have been doctors who have been threatened by professional bodies hearing and trying to disbar them and so on. But in cancer, that at what point, let's just suppose for a second that someone like Mukherjee is right, that we need to look at the other side. Who decides that? How does that work? What is the body that says we need, we need to have a change? Maybe the evidence-based system on its own is not enough. I mean, there's an interesting analogy, I think, it came to me the other day, which was with capitalism, there's this theory that there is a thing called the invisible hand of the market. And if you've got the pure capitalists, they say, well, you shouldn't interfere with the market. You shouldn't try to put price controls on or cap this and so on and so forth. The nature of the market is such that it will be adjusted. When there's too much in one direction, there'll be an opposing force, and the invisible hand of the market will keep things moving along. Interestingly, I don't want to get too caught up in this, but you can trace this back. There are sort of social historians who've done it to say that actually it's really the hand of God. It's a kind of religious idea that sort of God will make sure that things are kind of all right. And that's really what this... And there is a similar thing seems to be going on in medicine where there's this sort of invisible hand of evidence-based medicine. It'll kind of make sure that the best treatments get through and the ones that don't work don't. But when you look at what's going on with cancer, the impossibility of moving out of this simply genes and simply drugs would suggest that there's a need for some kind of big hand of God to come down.
A very big one, yeah.
And down some tablets.
We're kind of cornered, but somehow things have got to move on. And I think that the force that's going to move them on at this point, rather like in diabetes, is actually the public, because they're informing each other about what works, because they're not satisfied with what they're told by their oncologist. And they might see that as a horribly scary situation, which of course it could be. All information isn't good information, but it's only happening out of necessity, because what's given isn't working.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Can I just, there's just one sort of area in the evidence-based system not working that ties in with where we started, which was how a lot of the drugs that were being licensed weren't really, they weren't licensed on a good basis. And even when they were followed up and found not to work, they still, nothing happened. And what was going on in America and what was going on in the EU between about 2010 and 2015 was something called the Cancer Drug Fund, which was set up to allow patients to have some of these drugs which had been nodded through as great breakthroughs, which subsequently, when they were looked at by NICE, which is a body that was set up to evaluate and is it worth putting money, they said, well, actually, the evidence for this is really pretty shitty. So it should have been an example of the evidence-based system working. But what the drug companies would do was they would say, look, guys, these drugs are licensed, which means that they've been through this process, which proves that they're effective and safe. And it's outrageous that these arbitrary government quango bodies are stopping patients from getting life-saving treatments. And this was then picked up by David Cameron, and I don't know what the internal supporters of this idea was, but there was the idea that we've set up NICE in order to check that the studies that the drugs that we're going to be giving people are value for money and are effective and do what they say. But we'll then set up a body which takes the drugs which have been rejected and makes them available to patients anyway. So I always thought that the Cancer Drug Fund was a bonkers, contradictory idea to begin with. And then when one of the things that came out of the BMJ study a couple of weeks ago was that a lot of the drugs which they had been looking at as being rushed through and then not turning out to be beneficial were made available, put into the pipeline via the Cancer Drug Fund. So it was picking up on all these duds and spending money, giving them to patients, supposedly on the grounds that, I don't know quite, that they were life-saving and somehow the other people had missed this fact. So in 2015, the Drugs Fund was closed down, and there was an investigation into how well it had done. And what they found, and this there was a report that I think came out early on this year, April or something, there were a couple of very good oncologists working at London hospitals who wrote a report on it, which found that the Cancer Drug Fund had spent £1.2 billion worth of money on these drugs. And so they then wanted to know, well, what did you get for it? And the result was, it looked like they increased lifespan by about 3 months, which was sort of ballpark figure. But then once that they'd taken into account the side effects, and I thought this was interesting because I wasn't aware that it was regularly done, but this study did. They said, well, look at, say, how much longer life do you get, but what sort of quality of life do you get in the process? And they said, they concluded that once you've taken into account the quality of life, the side effects the patients had to go through, there was no clinical benefit whatsoever. So the cancer establishment, supposedly following the evidence, managed to spend £1 billion on drugs which resulted in no clinical benefit whatsoever. I mean, this must be a system that is A, not being regulated properly, and not following its own rules of evidence-based medicine either.
Well, yeah, pretty damning. Great for some drug companies, I think, at $1.2 billion, but not great for patients. Again, perhaps I'll leave it there, Jerome. That's quite a salutary tale.
Right.
Thanks so much for chatting about these really important topics today. I think that, you know, the public's becoming increasingly aware of the devastating effects that are the continued result of entrusting our healthcare to corporations, because, of course, their avowed intent is to make money first and foremost. And it's about time to reclaim our healthcare and make sure it's centred on us, not on profits.
Absolutely great that you're there as a not entirely lone voice saying, hang on, there is something better to do. I think it's a brilliant service.
OK, Jerome, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Robin.
So the question I'm left with is, how bad do the results of EBM have to get before there's a fundamental change in our approach? If you'd like to look at material linked to today's discussion, then go to the Yes to Life website, that's yestolife.org.uk, and click the link on the homepage to the Yes to Life show. Tickets are selling fast for our annual Yes to Life conference in London on the 25th of November. This will be an opportunity to hear pioneering leaders in healthcare such as Dr. Rangan Chatterjee, a BBC doctor in the house, speaking on the subject of starting the conversation, exploring ways in which integrating conventional cancer care and lifestyle medicine can improve outcomes. To book your place, click the link on the Yes to Life homepage, that's yestolife.org.uk. Hope you'll be able to join me again next week. Goodbye.